what I want to do is lean on the handout is from Dickerson, calls on representation opportunity. And I'm going to use, lean on his outline. I'll make certain critical comments about Allison and others along the way. But what I want to say to you now is, although you don't know it, you've already got in your possession all the elements of the whole second edition production. But there's almost nothing in it that we have not already covered. That's why we haven't done it as an argument. So I'm going to start now, and we just catch up on paragraphs 15 and 16. So the first page of the handout, it's two pages. One little page. You seem to have lots of second pages and we're missing some first pages.
Okay. I have some.
Can you share some of the first pages? I don't need it. Yeah, that's the first. The one with the little one, just that's it. It's the first page. And if you don't have it, I'll bring in some more next time. Sorry. Sitting there.
Nice.
Oh, we got tons of this. Who else doesn't have a first page? Yeah, didn't even get around there. Here we go. Two pages. And strangely enough, it runs from one through whatever it is. The crux of paragraphs 15 and 16, which is what I want to focus on, maybe we'll get to 17 today, and then we'll finish it off next week. As I say, I just think it's going to be easy if you look over this outline, think about it over this week, you will discover really that we're almost there. We need to be drawn together.
Do you need a chair?
I don't need a chair. And the hint I want to give you is there are three things that we've already talked about that are secreted in the structure of the me-deduction. They are, first, the argument we just gave about the non-isolatability of the I-think and its implication in every judgment. The I-think must be able to accompany all my representations. The second thing that we've talked about a lot, here all over the place, is my strange argument concerning the transcendental object equals X. Namely, that Kantian transcendental idealism is a transcendental reinterpretation of the new way of ideas. A transcendental reinterpretation of Lockean idealism empiricism. Right there in paragraph 15 and 16, I'm going to show you. And thirdly, that's all about the metaphysical deduction. It's all about the logical functions of judgment and the relation between them and categories. So all that you already know is everything is the argument from paragraph 15 to paragraph 20. So on all accounts, you will have heard the rumor that the argument of the transcendental deduction comes in two parts. Roughly, and there's variations on this, but roughly the argument runs from paragraph 15 through, paragraph 20, 21. Let's say just there's an argument that runs from paragraph 15 throughout paragraph 21, and then it is concluded in paragraph 26, which is part two. And there's a kind of some material in between that I'll say something about. So it's a two-part argument, and we'll talk about that next week. So, paragraphs 15 and 16. As Dickerson lays it out, the background, the fundamental background of the entire thing is representationalism. And when you hear representationalism, I want you to hear a version of Lockeanism. That is, we are aware, immediately, we are aware of representations of objects. That our awareness of objects is intentional. And that begins with the thought, as Dickerson rightly says, that all cognition occurs via the mind's immediate awareness of its own internal representational states. It's just step one. So if you're a representationalist, the way we have cognition of the world is by having representations of the world. And really, what are the alternatives here? Well, either if you're not a representationalist, you're going to be some sort of realist. And realism always just looks like it's going to be problematic because it's going to make no sense of either judgment, activity, or illusion, right? So we all have kind of realist, perceptual realist intuitions. I'm aware of the thing, but it can't be right. It can't be that I'm directly aware of the thing, rather I have a representation of the thing. Now, representations, step two, are not intrinsically available to the subject's awareness. That is, unconscious representations are possible. Did you ever, let me see if I can get you some unconscious representations. I don't know about you, but the ones that scare the hell out of me is when I'm driving. And I suddenly notice it's 20 minutes later and 40 miles later. How did I get here? I don't remember. I wasn't aware of the road along the way. I was thinking about something else. I was my consciousness was attending to the fight I just had with my wife. But somehow, I managed to drive 20 miles. Well, it's right to say, and I want to be clear, that what's occurred here are representations, because I have been triggering my response to the world in the light of what I have been perceiving, even if I wasn't consciously apperceiving that input. Now, of course, life would be terrifying if it was like that all the time. But so unconscious representations are possible. But cognition, actual cognition, making claims about what is there and being aware of it and being able to draw inferences from it and the like, therefore involves more than having representations, right? It involves a special form of bringing representations to awareness, which we're going to simply call apperceiving them. So the I think must be able to come in all my representations in order for there to be a cognitive claim. So let's be aware now that what we're analyzing are our cognitive states. I'm going to say that's, I'm going to have to be very clear, and we'll come back much more next week, but I want to be clear. The premise for me of the entire deduction is I have cognitive awareness of the world. My claim is that ain't in dispute. Roy's written a very nice paper about that. And that what we're doing is giving an analysis of that, right? Not asking the question, totally different question, how we move from subjective experience to objective awareness. That was what everyone, that's what lots of writers want Kant to be doing, and I'm claiming he doesn't do, and I'm pretty sure cannot be done. That is, I think defeating skepticism in that sense is impossible. So I am skeptical about the possibility of anti-skeptical arguments. Well, why? The reason why we'll come over and over again, but the reason is going to be this. That there is no cognitive path from the non-cognitive to the cognitive. And that seems to me what an anti-skeptical argument would have to be convincing. That is a cognitive path from the non-cognitive to the cognitive, and yet, as I say it, that must be a contradiction in terms. Another way of saying the same thing, which is the way that you'll see Dickerson state over and over again, is we begin holistically, that there's no lower level of cognition beneath the judgment. So judgment is where we start from, not where we get to. So I want to say subjective states, let's call them states of non-knowledge, are not the conditions of knowledge, but the collapse of knowledge. Now, I'll say more about why I think anti-skepticism is a state, but I want to set up this notion now of what I'm calling holism. That is, we must start with the whole, and from the whole analyze the parts, not move
from the parts to, through some magical synthesis or progression, get to the whole. Right? That's what's called a progressive argument. So I am offering what's called a regressive argument rather than a synthetic or progressive argument. Now, what we're analyzing, cognitive states of what or who? Well, cognitive states of what Kant says over and over again is a discursive mind, where a discursive mind is the opposite of intellectual intuition. A discursive mind, by definition for Kant, is a mind that is receptive of a world that exists fully independently of it. So, two things here. One is the notion of independence. When God thinks, let there be light, there's light. The thought and the thing are absolutely identical. So God's notion of intellectual intuition means for God there is never a difference between possibility and actuality. That's rough and readily the notion of an intuitive intellect, one for which there is no gap between possibility. Great cold beer would be good now, right? Well, God doesn't have to wait, right? The thought of the cold beer is enough for there to be cold beer and the soothing of it. I guess God can't be soothed, because that's receptive, passive. Which, by the way, one great writer, Rousseau, said, that's the sad thing about being a God. He never knows comfort or solace, because he has no needs. Only a needing being can have comfort or solace. That's a beautiful, and even if there is a God, it's pathetic. Not a being you'd want to be. Okay, but then the second thought is, goes along with the difference between possibility and actuality, is therefore we are, and the world is independent of us, follows, we have to be receptive. We are passive with respect to the world. There has to be a moment of irredeemable, irreducible passivity. Has to be a sense in which the world must affect us or connect with us or impact on us in order for us to have cognition of it. And this, as we know already, gets rid of all rationalism, right? Which have no thought of passivity at all. So a discursive mind is a receptive one. Therefore, step five now, in cognition, the discursive mind apperceives its own internal states as presenting an independent objective world to itself. So if I'm a discursive intelligence, and if all knowledge is representation and all representation is apperceptive, then what an apperceptive mind apperceives are its own internal states as representing an independent world.
since an independent world is a world capable of being sensed, then all discursive cognition is apperception of this sensible intuitions. That is, things in space and time. I have to be affected by it. That's what it means to be sensible. I have to be affected by them. Then the individuals that I am affected by must themselves be sensible. Further, all objects are sensible and representation are complex. Complexity follows merely from sensibility, because at least if it's spatio or temporal, it's going to be divisible. So we never have an awareness of something that is absolutely simple. Simplicity is always a result of a kind of analytic work of the mind. Even, you know, a sound can be analyzed into timbre, volume, or tone. How many elements do they have? Many. I look at the expert. The answer is many. Good. I'm glad I got the expert here. but that's the point is, you know, even when you're listening to one note, when, you know, the orchestra's tuning, you're listening to a manifold itself. Which is why we say some people have perfect pitch and others don't. If it was absolutely simple, we'd all have perfect pitch. But we don't, because actually it's a complex manifold that needs to be intuited and therefore reproduced in certain ways. So we're always aware of an intuitive manifold. Therefore, discursive cognition, and we're just, notice I'm not, there's no argument here, I'm analyzing. Therefore, discursive cognition is the apperception of a unified, complex representation. That's just what discursive cognition is. And now that's the background, that's what we're going to analyze, discursive cognition. That's our object analysis. That's where we're going, right? That's where we're starting from and trying to think about what are the necessary conditions for the possibility of us having discursive cognition, having this apperceptive awareness of a unified, complex representation. Well, first sentence of paragraph 16 the most famous in all of the text is, right, it must be possible for the I think to accompany all my representations, for otherwise something would be represented in me which could not be thought at all, and that is equivalent to saying that the representation would be impossible, or at least would be nothing to me. The meaning of that claim is a claim about, I'm going to suggest, or I've been arguing, is really a claim about unity. To say the I think must accompany all my representations means I must be aware of this complex field as hanging together in a unified way. That is, I must be aware of it as some sort of whole.
And I take it, the reason, Dickerson claims, I think rightly, that that's still an analytic thing. Still about discursive cognition. And it's an analytic claim is a claim about what it is to be aware of something. And that's still compatible. Let me give this example. Sometimes when people think about Locke, people confuse, and they go off my glasses for a reason, because I can't see anything about them. People confuse physical images with Lockean ideas. A Lockean idea is not the same as an image on the retina of my eye. For when I hold up the bottle, I have one idea, even though each of my eyes, right, has a reversed image of the thing imprinted upon it. But that's not what I'm aware of, even as a Lockean. So a Lockean idea is still itself an intentional object, not the physical thing that comes in, but the one thing I'm aware of that I know. I'll give up class. Let us stop there. That's another o'clock. It is 8 o'clock. We will pick up right there next week. You'll have a chance to kind of work over this and think it through, and maybe have a looser meeting. We'll have, again, a 5-minute break, and those who